After 7 trips around the hotel, we're here now. I'd like to introduce the opening session of the Sunstone Theological Symposium. Like the tigers of old time, history and censorship, Davis Bitton will be first professor of history at the University of Utah.
How did all of you find this room when the speaker could not? I was looking for something called Ballroom 2, but this, anyway, here we are. The title, Like the Tigers of Old Time, is somewhat mysterious, but somewhere in the middle of the paper it will become clear, I hope. Although censorship, in the simple sense, is something we do not take kindly to in our society, we are familiar enough with expressions of concern over books, magazines, movies, and television. Too much sex and violence is the usual concern. Conservative-minded people tend to be fearful of the influence of license or pornography in society in general, seeing it as both a cause and a symptom of the erosion of our society's moral standards. But history. Why should the guardians of standards be concerned about history? Why should they disapprove of certain kinds of historical writing and do everything in their power to foster others? Yet this is precisely what has happened. The kind of writing that on the face of it deals with the past, with things that are dead and gone, somehow touches a tender nerve. I have chosen to examine 3 different areas in which the writing of history has aroused apprehension on the part of institutional leaders. Apprehension led to control, or efforts to control, the research and writing of history. History, that sweet muse dedicated to instruction and truth, was to a degree bound and gagged, or at least forced to read a script prepared by her captors. Let us start with England in the 16th century, the age of the Tudors. As part of the intellectual format of this century was a renewal of attention to the past. This could take the form of histories of the world, of ancient Greece and Rome, of early Britain, or the Norman conquest, events in the 15th century, or of many other subjects. These may seem to us to have been far enough removed from the Tudor present to be irrelevant and unthreatening to those in power at the time of writing. But such was not the case. Let me offer some examples. As background, we must remember that there had been a long struggle between the houses of Lancaster and York before finally in 1485 Henry Tudor had ascended the throne as Henry VII. Anxious to see that the history of the preceding period was handled in a way that would not threaten the legitimacy of the Tudors, Henry imported an Italian by the name of Polydore Virgil, who chronicled the reigns of the English kings in a way that was clearly acceptable to his master. One of the stereotypes that was considered essential, for example, was to portray Richard III, the last Yorkist king, as a kind of monster, a bogeyman. This process was continued throughout the century, while the Tudor kings took on all the virtues imaginable. He who pays the piper calls the tune. When Shakespeare wrote his history plays in the latter part of the reign of Elizabeth, he of course continued the Richard III as monster theme. In Richard II, another play of Shakespeare's, a deposition scene was included. To leave out the deposition of Richard II, many generations earlier, would be like leaving out the resignation of Richard Nixon from the history of his presidency. But the Queen, uneasy at the possibility that a deposition scene might suggest something that the playgoers would not otherwise think of, let her concerns be known. The scene was cut from all printings in her lifetime. An earnest young historian by the name of John Hayward, trained as a lawyer and what we would call a history buff, decided to reconstruct the details of Richard II's deposition. Accompanied by a fulsome dedication to the Queen's close friend and advisor, the Earl of Essex, Hayward's book appeared in 1599. The Queen was not amused. The dedication, which might have been taken as an implicit endorsement by the Crown, was ordered removed. A second edition without the dedication appeared. It was gathered up and burned. Then Hayward was brought in for interrogation by none other than Sir Edward Cook. The notes of this stormy questioning session survive. Hayward had described a bad ruler, Richard II, a corrupt council, discontented nobles, and the mass of common people groaning under heavy taxation. The cure for these, according to Hayward's account, was the deposition of the king. When Hayward protested that he had simply been true to the historical record, Cook declared that Hayward had intended the application of it to this time. All of Hayward's denials were to no avail. After a second interrogation, he was taken to the Tower and kept incarcerated until after the Queen's death. The Privy Council did not stop by dealing with this one writer. It issued an order that no works on English history be published without express approval. One scholar, the great William Camden, gained access to many of the official documents, but he knew what was wanted and did not press his luck. I'm quoting him now. He said, "Things manifest and evident I have not concealed. Things doubtful I have interpreted favorably. Things secret and abstruse I have not pried into." Suspicion of what the historians might do continued under James I. Like his predecessors, James was very careful about allowing access to the archives. The result was sickening adulation, as found, for example, in one historian who praised James's, quote, "chastity, patience, piety, mercy, judgment, wisdom, learning, bounty, peace, and munificence." Samuel Daniel promised that he would be very careful with any sources he used. He would, quote, "tread as tenderly on the graves of his magnificent progenitors as possibly I can," end quote. James was still suspicious, and when a group of scholars tried to organize a society of antiquaries, even though they intended to refrain from discussing religion or matters of state, James growled his displeasure. Before the second meeting, according to Sir Henry Spelman, "we had noticed that His Majesty took a little mislike of our society." They met no more. Sir Walter Raleigh's great History of the World dealt with ancient times, the pre-Christian era. It might be thought that this was far enough removed to cause no problem. But Raleigh's intention, according to his critics, was to, quote, "tax the vices of those that are yet living in their persons that are long since dead." He protested his innocence, saying, quote, "if there be any that finding themselves spotted like the tigers of old time shall find fault with me for painting them ever anew, they shall therein accuse themselves justly and me falsely." May I read that one more time? "If there be any that finding themselves spotted like the tigers of old time shall find fault with me for painting them anew, they shall therein accuse themselves justly and me falsely." I think we say something a little more simple: if the shoe fits, wear it. He did not choose to write about events closer to the present, Raleigh said, "for whosoever in writing a modern history," quoting him now, "whosoever in writing a modern history shall follow truth too near the heels, it may haply strike out his teeth." But as he discovered, and as others discovered, it was the perception of the establishment that mattered. If history was perceived to be embarrassing or threatening or suggestive of problems or too closely parallel to present conditions or in any way discomforting, it was to be discouraged. The way to prevent the publication of unwelcome history in Tudor England included patronage of the favored kinds of history, refusal of access to archival materials, demands that offensive passages be deleted, removal from the bookstores, insistence that the books be cleared by a committee before publication, and imprisonment of historians who caused problems. More important than any of these specific measures was the awareness of what might befall a historian lacking in discretion. Now, jumping across time, as is the historian's prerogative, we will move to the 19th century. Early in the 19th century, as the archives in Italy were being opened up to research, coinciding with the rise of modern historical scholarship and an intensive interest in national origins, scholars began to show an interest in the materials of the Vatican. The procedure, if you got permission to use the material at all, was that someone would copy it out for you. You would not see the original text and would not even have a chance to compare in order to ascertain the accuracy of the transcription. It was in this period of time that a German historian, G.H. Peretz, wrote the following: "There is no better defense of the papacy than to unveil its inward being. If weakness is shown up, you can reckon on a more friendly judgment through historical understanding than if, as often until now, it is all kept secret and men are left to suspect what they will." One of the subjects that scholars wanted to explore was the trial of Galileo. But this was one subject the officials did not want looked at. It had to be enemies of the church who were interested in looking at such an incident and hoping to discredit the institution and its leaders. What they did not understand, apparently, was that there was no version that scholarship might possibly produce with complete access to the sources that could be as bad and as unfavorable to the church as the simplified rumors that were making the rounds and being accepted as accurate. The history of the Council of Trent is another example. The Council of Trent is the great ecumenical church council of the 16th century. Sarpi's version was countered. Sarpi's critical anti-papal version was countered by Pallavicino's defensive official version. Both were partisan. The primary sources were used selectively by these two near-contemporary authors, and for many generations were not available for checking. Historians see the past through the eyes of the authors of the archives which they use, Owen Chadwick has wisely noticed. Later, when an effort was made to publish the complete sources for this council, of course, it would have included speeches, and some of those speeches would have contained ideas unacceptable to the church. The suggestion was made that this be done only if footnotes were provided to refute the erroneous ideas contained in some of these speeches. Some church officials did not want any further publication of sources or any additional history because they would tend to undermine the official history of Pallavicino that already existed. Although the subject being examined, the Council of Trent, was in the 16th century, it was in the 19th century that this whole question was going through a re-examination. Scholarly efforts, I'm referring to those by Catholics, to re-examine the Council of Trent were constantly frustrated by the feeling that it would not do to stir the waters. One historian answered that if we Catholics are going to be secretive, restrictive, and defensive with our historical documents, how can we proclaim boldly that history is on our side? Or how can we criticize the Protestants for behaving similarly with their sources? The relevance of this 16th century history was unmistakable at the Vatican Council of 1869 and 70. It's the first Vatican Council. The main question, at least the main result of this council, was the official promulgation of the doctrine of papal infallibility, that when speaking ex cathedra on matters of faith and morals, the Pope cannot err. Now, this was a historical question, at least in part, because it necessitated showing that the belief had been held by a cloud of witnesses, by the uninterrupted tradition of the Church, and that previous papal announcements had, in fact, been infallible. Both sides in this controversy in 1869 and 70 appealed to history by necessity, but those advancing the infallibilist position appealed to forged, spurious or mutilated documents. They interpreted passages to their own advantage, making history say what they wanted it to say, constructing an image of the past that had very little to do with historical reality. Now, those words should be in quotation marks. I'm quoting a recent Catholic history of the First Vatican Council entitled "How the Pope Became Infallible." When certain historians complained about the misuse of their discipline, they were denounced. "Dogma must triumph over history," was the saying. Not that the proponents of papal infallibility ignored history, rather they misused it, ignoring or suppressing what they found inconvenient, misinterpreting or misemphasizing what the documents according to their purposes. Then there was a cover-up. Following the First Vatican Council, the way the history of that council that finally did issue its official pronouncement was dealt with subsequent to 1870. It would not do to have the faithful Catholics of the world know how these matters had been decided. So the documents of the First Vatican Council were restricted. An official historian was appointed to write the history of the council, the approved version. Other participants who kept records or who intended to produce histories were discouraged, their notes restricted, and in some cases destroyed. In 1883, it seemed that a landmark had been reached. The Vatican Council was over now for 13 years. Pope Leo XIII, a broad-minded pope, stated, "The Catholic Church and the Holy See have nothing to fear from the truth of history." The principle was first stated in a letter to three cardinals. "The Church has no anxiety before the truth," he said, speaking to a meeting of the Gorus Society, the German Catholic Society for the Study of History. He said, "Go to the sources. That is why I have opened the archives to you. We are not afraid of people publishing documents out of them." Marvelous quotation from Pope Leo XIII. One of the fruits of this new open attitude after Vatican I was the great project of Ludwig von Pasteur, who was granted permission to produce a multi-volume history of the popes. The instructions he was given by Leo XIII were that he should work on the project con amore, with love. A truly great historian, with thoroughness, indefatigable energy, scope of vision, and a capacity for human understanding, Pasteur explained, "The Catholic historian must not be an apologist. This is a danger which presses in these controversial days. A historian who struggles for impartiality will not be so respected in his own day as the historian who is an apologist, for the second is the man of the moment. Later, it is the other way around. The impartial historian does not die with his generation. The apologist is understood by his party, but to posterity he is nothing but a pamphleteer." Thus, Pasteur. Try reading him sometime. His multi-volume history of the popes is on the shelves of university libraries at least, and just sampling a volume can be a very good example of how a dedicated, loyal historian can write excellent history. The reactions to Pasteur are interesting. At first, the Protestants condemned him as an apologist, but quickly they developed a grudging admiration as his volumes continued to appear, as he demonstrated thoroughness, and as he said what in honesty had to be said about Alexander VI. Some Catholics deplored the history, wanting to place his history on the index of prohibited books. "You should not say unkind things about the dead," said one cardinal. "First charity and then truth, even in writing history." Fortunately, one man not swayed by these criticisms was Pope Leo XIII. Such is the importance of having a champion in the right time and place. Pasteur's work continued to appear and stands today as one of the monuments of modern historical scholarship, a tribute to the church that produced it, encouraged it, and miracle of miracles, continued to survive and grow during and after the publication of the work. But such brave words were easier expressed than carried into practice. An archivist named Balin, one who was vigorous in preventing materials from being too readily available, himself came under suspicion. Rumors abounded. He had pirated out documents. He was selling them, writing pamphlets for the opposition, showing poor judgment. These were the rumors, rumors that were sufficient to lead to his quiet promotion. One way the scholars were kept from the documents was simply to have the documents uncatalogued. Thus, it was possible, whenever the inclination was there, to say, "We don't have that," or "We don't have any way of finding that," or "Come back in 5 years and perhaps we will have these processed." These were documents that, for practical purposes, did not exist. There was always a certain amount of looking over one's shoulder, trying to second-guess what those higher-up wished. Despite his specific statement that he wanted the archives open, Pope Leo XIII was thought to have stated, or someone heard that he wished, that no one wished no one to pursue research on the notorious Borgia Pope, Alexander VI. The private understanding of what the authorities wanted governed what the men working in the archives made available. History is on our side, Pope Leo XIII is supposed to have said. Historians who wanted access to the record, and those who saw the proceedings of the archivists as high-handed, those whose own views were ignored and suppressed, might have found this hard to believe. They would have liked the current bumper sticker, "History is on our side as long as we can control the historians." But let us not be too hard on the Vatican and its archival policies. These matters must be considered in the context of what general standards are at a given time. As Owen Chadwick has reminded us, the protective and restrictive attitudes were not confined to the Vatican archives. I'm quoting Owen Chadwick now. He said, even in 1916, the German Foreign Office ruled that to publish the political testament of King Frederick the Great of Prussia was inopportune. The Italian government long refused access to its state archives, and its agents tried to prevent historians getting too near the papers of Cavour or of the Royal House. It would not be right, said an Italian prime minister in 1912, to have beautiful legends discredited by historical criticism. There had been progress during the 19th century toward a greater freedom of access, and the trend continued in the present century. Despite these certain problems, such as I've just alluded to, one must grant in fairness that scholars have been granted a remarkable cooperation, as scores of historical works in our own generation attest. And the results have not been to degrade the Catholic Church because of its human failings, but to add to its luster as an institution with enough strength and confidence to face its own past. Finally, hoping to be somewhat fair and casting stones at everybody, I come to the writing of Mormon history. I do not have time to survey this whole process in detail. In part, we are just now starting to understand what went on. But we know enough, and some of the experiences are close enough, that I can mention a few things. For a long time, and to some extent still, the interest in the history of the church was combined with the assumption that there is one true version of that history. How often I've heard the guides over in the church office building say, here is where they write the history of the church. That word "the" is very interesting, as if there is a single history of the church. The assumption that there's one true version, you see. Thus, the work of compiling and gathering into the so-called history of Brigham Young and the history of Joseph Smith, they were thought of as writing the history of the church. This was an effort to produce a reliable account of the past. But, of course, it required the choice between competing accounts, the smoothing out of differences, some textual emendations, and some people still think in this way. Quite early in the process of working up Mormon history, the reading committee was used as a means of clearing and getting a group judgment. Since the same device was used for works of theology, it is clear that the church leadership recognized the possibility of problems from versions of history that did not fit into the image they had in mind. The reading committee approach is still around. The idea that nothing negative should be said about past church leaders was a natural consequence of the position that nothing negative should be said about present leaders. Sustaining the authorities includes the idea for Mormons, we all grew up with this, that one does not tear down, criticize, or otherwise resist the decisions of the leadership. In the church context, this position seems natural, and it functions in promoting unity and a sense of confidence in the institution. The Catholic cardinal who said charity before truth, even in history, expressed the attitude I heard in a slightly different words from the Mormon archivist A. William Lund. I was just an undergraduate in history and was working on a paper dealing with B.H. Roberts. And Brother Lund came to me and he asked this incredible question, which left me totally speechless. Now, what good will that do anyone to know? Now, maybe that's a good question. But what historian could accomplish anything of significance by working with such self-doubt, or by accepting the handicap that nothing negative must be said, or that you must demonstrate the good that this is going to do before you proceed on a subject, knowing the truth is a certain good in itself? Control over the history of the church that is produced is never total, but the church has sometimes sought to exercise some control. The procedure has not always been well understood, and perhaps has not been coordinated, nor has it always been official or expressive of a unanimous decision by the presiding councils of the church. But let me list a few of the techniques by which this is accomplished to a greater or lesser degree. I could provide examples, but I'll simply list these. First, limiting access of researchers and writers to materials. Second, allowing the materials to be examined, but looking over the research notes and forbidding certain details to be extracted from the primary materials. Third, encouraging or discouraging publication through church channels, church magazines, BYU Press, Deseret Book, and Bookcraft. I list that as a church channel because it functions effectively as one. Other publishers have tried to get on this bandwagon, and thus have been careful to publish only approved works, cleared works, that they are sure present no problems. Fourth, encouraging or discouraging works that have been published by carrying them or not carrying them in the church outlets. I'm referring to Deseret Book primarily and all of its various outlets. 70s bookstores would be another very important example. Since the market is extremely important to the economic viability of publishers, it is crucial not to alienate those who make the decisions. And so if you have any kind of indication that the work may not be carried, the book might not get published in the first place. Then there is this rather insidious technique of letting it be known that certain works that are produced are somehow less than kosher. The procedure here ranges from talks in certain groups, telephone calls, statements by secretaries or assistants to some of the general authorities, and, of course, the rumor mill. Third and fourth hand statements that so-and-so doesn't think too much of this book. He may or may not have read it. In some societies, I would guess, such disapproval would be the surest way to guarantee the success of a work. But apparently in our circles, it has rather good success in stifling historical writing. And a final little variant on these techniques is that works that have succeeded in gaining publication and may even be carried for sale in these retail outlets that I've referred to can be kept from the knowledge of the reading public by simply not reviewing them in the daily newspaper or the weekly church news. The decision of whether or not to mention a given work in the Deseret News or the church news is a very important decision. And who makes those decisions and on what grounds? It can be crucial in the dissemination of a work. Although there is nothing in all this that sounds as ominous as an index of prohibited books, I do not see the procedure as anywhere near as clearly defined and responsible as those which Catholics use for the Nihil Obstat and the Imprimatur. The results, the cumulative results, can be powerful. It should be clear that history, far from being considered a harmless interest somewhere between novel reading and stamp collecting, has been viewed as a prickly, troublesome threat with a power to do real damage. In Elizabeth's England, in late 19th century Catholicism, in 20th century Mormonism, various efforts were made to tame Cleo, making her subservient to church or state. My conclusion is not going to be only the cheap and easy one of calling for freedom in the research and writing of history. That is one part of what I want to say. Those in positions of leadership in church or state, those who become concerned about speeches and writing they dislike, should once a year read John Stuart Mill on liberty. They should commit it to memory. Better still, they should understand it, believe it, and carry out its precepts. You'll remember that Mill appealed for the free expression of ideas, not only because true and valuable ideas might otherwise be suppressed, but also because of what the absence of comparison does to those holding sound positions. If the opinion is right, he said, They are deprived of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. If wrong, they lose what is almost as great a benefit, the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth produced by its collision with error. History, which authority figures have feared, has, as all three of our case studies demonstrate, turned out to be quite within the capacity of the institution to endure. Mill would say that an institution that does not have that capacity does not deserve to endure. On a more pragmatic level, we can simply observe that the worst fears of the censoring mind are not realized. Life goes on. Some adaptation is made if that is required, or counterversions to the unwelcome history are produced. Scholarship continues its dialectical movement one generation after another. We vastly overestimate the extent to which people are motivated by such things as history, and we underestimate their capacity for adjustment and enlarging and reformulating earlier views. Most of the time, it seems to me, institutions are better off by encouraging access to information and allowing good and well-researched history to be a standing rebuke and answer to shoddy partisan history. But in deference to what the historians come up with, a complete willingness to let the research and writing take place without let or hindrance, an opening up of the archives in their totality to any and all research, such a situation is not in the cards. We will continue to experience tension in one way or another, which is to say that researchers will continue to push for access to documents and will write up their findings, while defenders of the bastions will find it necessary to draw lines and exercise restraints. Some line drawing is going to take place, like it or not. And I can only state that on the basis of the examples we have considered here, it is better to err on the side of openness, cooperation with the researchers, and a confidence that historical truth will not ultimately prove damaging to anything that deserves to survive. And I can only state that on the basis of the examples we have considered here, it is better to err on the side of openness, cooperation with the researchers, and a confidence that historical truth will not ultimately prove damaging to anything that deserves to survive. History is not as far removed from us as we sometimes think. Its tendrils reach from the near or distant past into our lives at many points. Concern over how much of history is revealed and how it is presented is the tribute paid by those who recognize that it is in fact relevant to the present. History is not the dead past, for it is not dead, and as someone has discerned, in many respects, it's not even past.
The response to Dr. Bitton's address will be given by Robert Goldberg, Associate Professor of History at the University of Utah.
Let me thank you, first of all, for the award of tenure. Professor Bitton's remarks clearly echo the old French proverb, "The more things change, the less they change." There is a consistency to human and institutional behavior which makes the past a window onto the present and the future. The continuous flow between past and future furnishes us the possibility of greater insight into our present condition and perhaps the avoidance of past pitfalls. While not always obvious and certainly not always heeded, the signs are there to guide man as an individual and man as a part of an institutional bureaucracy. Professor Bitton reviews two past series of events to shed light upon a current and closer yet very similar situation. In 16th century England and 19th century Rome, institutional authorities attempted to launder the past. If the historians could be bridled, the past would be less threatening and made to conform to the wishes of the powerful. The tools of censorship were varied: restriction of access to manuscripts, banning of books, imprisonment, and financial coercion, among others. The result? Short-sighted victory and long-term failure. Works of history with the official stamp of approval did not survive their time, never to be taken seriously by scholars. Gossip and rumors stoked continuous waves of controversy. If all is above board and proper, why the darkness and secrecy? along a different line. What does the institution's stance reflect about its perceptions of its own followers and believers? Is their faith and sense of loyalty so fragile, so questionable, that the past must be distorted to retain their allegiance? Is censorship, then, simply a symptom of a wider defensiveness and fear? Armed with these two incidents, knowing both prologue and epilogue, Bitten approaches an institution which impinges upon our lives far more than King James's court or Pope Leo's Vatican. The LDS Church today, he writes, is following the pattern of seeking to control its past by restricting research materials, censorship, and financial intimidation of historians and their publishers. Will the results be the same? Bitten doesn't explicitly say. But if the previous case studies are guides, then we may ask, will church-approved histories be judged merely as broadsides in theological debates? Will non-Mormon suspicion and concern of a closed church grow? And again, the most serious question, how much faith does a church which sanctions only histories of milk but not meat have in its own congregants? Professor Bitten's paper suggests two larger questions as well. The first concerns the nature of historical inquiry. History is the study of man in past time. Human beliefs, behaviors, values, both individual and collective, comprise the sphere of historical inquiry. The study is subject, the historian searches for artifacts, evidence such as diaries, newspapers, and journals. He selects among the bits and pieces of evidence for those relevant to his work. He realizes that all the evidence is not available and that each source contains its own bias. These fragments of the past then pass through a screen called the historian's brain. He considers the evidence of the past according to an explicit or implicit conceptual framework. The result is an interpretation of past reality. All history is thus an interpretation. Several interrelated points follow from my discussion. First, history is not a series of dates nor a packet of facts once memorized exposes the student to a secret world of truth. There is no gospel of historical truth waiting to be read or snatched. All has been touched by human hands. Second, one historical interpretation is not necessarily equal to another, just as it is absurd to contend that one opinion is as good as another. The objectivity, if I may use that term, the objectivity of an interpretation is found in its confirmation or negation by tests of logic and evidence. Third, history is not teleological. It is beyond the historian's role and powers to prove the hand of God in human events. Historians are able and should consider the religious nature of man along with his political, social, and cultural orientations. Beyond this, the evidence forbids them to hypothesize. Finally, the past is non-ideological. It carries no sword for any political, religious, or social cause. Historians, again, are prohibited by tests of logic and evidence to use the past to prove the truth of one creed over another. Serious scholars refrain from enlisting in wars of faith promotion, whether in the service of king, pope, or church. The second major question in the topic of Professor Bitten's essay is censorship. We Americans maintain a view of history which envisions a constant progression toward a better world, whether measured in terms of financial security, health care, scientific advances, or race relations. We hold this faith in a continuous progress despite a series of 20th century earthquakes. Our past cousins we believe to have been restrictive, more inhibited, more intolerant, far more benighted than us on subjects such as religion, personal habits, or the freedoms of speech, press, or opinion. But as Bitten suggests, are we so different than those who came before? More specifically, how unusual is the Mormon Church's restrictive stance toward historical research? The vast majority of nations vigorously guard their historical archives, allowing only the safe few to enter. Even our government, with one of the most liberal access policies, has blemishes upon its record. For example, Alan Weinstein's study of the Cold War Hiss Chambers controversy ignited a 5-year court battle with the United States government and spurred the FBI to open a file in his name. Just last week, the newspapers carried a report that the Reagan administration is seeking to suppress evidence of domestic spying operations conducted in the 1960s and 1970s against American radicals. The administration has also emitted signals recently of a need to revise the Freedom of Information Act in light of budgetary difficulties. Outside of the government, censorship remains a major obstacle for scholars. In my own research, organizations ranging from the NAACP to the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the Odd Fellows have either restricted or prohibited access to historical materials in their possession. My point is that the Mormon Church's restrictions should be condemned, and all actions should be taken to revise that policy. At the same time, the Church's actions should be not taken in isolation. Our society is more closed than we believe, the road to free inquiry more heavily barricaded than we think. As disturbing as the blatant problem of censorship is one which I believe can be even more insidious. To ensure promotion, to retain an academic position, to publish a book or an article, scholars might take the easy path of self-censorship. They pull their intellectual punches. They shy away from controversial topics. They cover up what they believe those in power don't wish exposed. We don't have to return to the distant past for examples. In the McCarthy period of the 1950s, self-censorship kept one out of the limelight and off the blacklist. We can see this reaction again today in the moral majority movement, moral majority wars over revolution. Self-censorship is a product of fear, which not only erodes the purpose of historical inquiry, but also demoralizes those who feel forced to practice it. I'd like to close my comments with a quotation. According to Hubie Brown, former member of the First Presidency of the LDS Church, "Preserve then the freedom of your mind in education and in religion, and be unafraid to express your thoughts, to insist upon the right to examine every proposition. We are not so much concerned whether your thoughts are orthodox as we are that you shall have thoughts." The Mormon Church, any church, must cultivate in its adherents an informed faith inspired by the free exchange of ideas. Self-criticism and self-examination better prepares believers to understand the divinity as well as the humanity of their institution. Knowledge and in its wake wisdom act to strengthen, not weaken, a church. We can expect no less of an American church that it actively nourish its followers with such principles. Thank you.
We are supposed to have been out of here 5 minutes ago, but unless I hear anything to the contrary, I think we should take some questions addressed to either Dr. Bitton, Dr. Goldberg, or both, and we'll see how long we can stay before we have to run. Yes, would you stand and state your question?
I have a question for Davis, and I'm wondering, as you look at some of the revelations in the Christian Science Church in Seventh-day Adventist, if the church is somewhat different from, say, a government in terms of its vulnerability to historical exposure.
Somewhat different in the sense of the...
The exposure seems to threaten the existence of those churches, and I suspect the people in our church worry about the same type of thing, whereas the existence of the government doesn't seem to hang on the whether or not some of these FBI records come to light.
Well, I think on the face of it, Sam, that looks to be true, but I seldom prophesy. I'm a historian, but I think I'll prophesy that both Christian Science and Seventh-day Adventism will be around throughout both of our lifetimes and beyond. The capacity for reinterpretation, reformulation is one of the things that human beings have developed to a high degree, and I think that we underestimate that. I understand what you're saying, but I don't believe that those entire movements are about to disappear by any historical revelation. I would be very surprised.
Yes?
I just wondered, I don't think you have time to answer this, but I'd like to know what you think is the best place to get a straight story of what we have had time
to do. You mean whom?
In the LDS Church.
Where are you addressing the question, please?
David.
Okay.
I mean, to what extent have they really closed? I mean, they haven't totally closed them, I'm not like that, but to what extent have they closed them?
Where is the best place to find out more about what's been going on?
The book called The Mormon Experience is... Well, you really have to make do with what's around, and you're right. We are not completely excluded from access. I hope I didn't leave that impression. Things are better now than they were 20 years ago. And we know most of what we need to know about many, many subjects, I think. And there are some good books. You might ask someone else for recommendations. I would recommend joining the Mormon History Association if you haven't done so. That's a good way to keep up with current research.
Yes.
My father was left medicine and doctors and left education educated to the first culture long, long ago. Can we make a case that society will be better off if historians, history of Western historians, related?
To both or to whom?
Both.
Okay.
Leave history to the historians. Let them be the only people who read and... Oh, if they had no restrictions on their access to material? Would society be better off? I imagine many of our problems would continue. But I think in terms of self-confidence in our institutions, we have a resilience that I think we ought to exercise. Maybe you prefer the term faith, that will hold up against these revelations that come out on matters of detail. That's my confidence in terms of church and state and everything else. I think we readjust and reinterpret, but that's part of the game of being human. That's all right. No problem with that. I probably didn't understand your question, but leaving history to historians, if that means barring all you wonderful history buffs and history readers, I'm certainly not interested in that. I think we're all interested in history, and everyone exercises it to some degree. Every man his own historian was the title of a famous address a few years ago. At any rate, that's a partial answer to your question.
I don't think either of us are contending that we should leave history to historians. In fact, what we believe as teachers of history is that people can be properly trained in the ideas of what is evidence, what is logic, what you can say about history. And therefore, I would echo that famous book's title, which is Every Man a Historian. There's no question about that.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes.
I'd like to address my question to Mr. Goldberg. You said in your remarks a couple of times that evidence forbids historians to publicize. A phrase you repeated over and over was historians are not forbidden. And I assume that you are referring to a historical code of some sort. I wonder if you haven't found another source of censorship for historians.
First of all, let me clarify remarks. Historians have got to hypothesize, got to make theoretical statements. What I am saying is there are certain areas that historians cannot tread upon. For example, historians cannot predict the supernatural in human events. The evidence is not available. We can't make statements about that. We can talk about the fact that some people are religious, some people had visions, and believe they had visions, and the people around them had visions. That's legitimate. But to prove that a vision occurred is illegitimate. That's what I'm arguing. I didn't understand the second part of your question. I really don't think so. I think that logic, if you want to use that as my words, and that's basically what I'm saying, tests of evidence and tests of logic prohibit us from saying certain things. The carpet is purple is illogical. That prohibits it. Is that a form of censorship? I don't think so.
Thank you very much. We have to make room for the next session. Thank you.